One of the areas of the world that we are very interested in and even sensitive to is because of Bible prophecy. That portion of the world is the Middle East. We know that at the end of this age, the Middle East will be the center of world-changing events, which will be part of the scenario of the return of Jesus Christ. The Arab hostility of Israel has dominated the region, and it is in a constant state of turmoil, with skirmishes and attacks taking place continually, always threatening to break out into a full-blown war. Since 1948, when the current nation of Israel was carved out of the region that had been lived in and held by the Palestinians, virtually every president of the United States has had his plan for bringing peace to the Middle East. But if anything, things are even more tense today than ever. I'm going to begin a series of sermons this afternoon, probably three, maybe another one. The title I've given to this series of sermons is Origins of the Middle East Crisis. How did it come to be the way it is today? And what does Bible prophecy say about the future? To understand the future, we need to take some time to look at the past. We need to understand the history of that region in order to fully appreciate prophecies of what will happen in the future. So this afternoon, we're going to begin looking back to see what happened in that part of the world to create the conditions that there are today. Today we're going to focus on the book of Genesis. Now you may have watched Dr. Levy's class, the Foundation Institute online class, on the book of Genesis. If you haven't seen that class, certainly I recommend that you do. I'm not trying to duplicate what Dr. Levy can do. I'm not capable of doing that. And I'm going to try not to just repeat what he said in the class. But I want to have more of a focused study, and we'll consider the account in Genesis that led to the situation as it exists today. The title of the series of sermons is Origin of the Middle East Crisis. The title of this particular sermon is The Two Families of Abraham. We know that it's through Abraham that physical blessings have enriched the descendants of the nation of Israel. But it's also important to remember that there is another family also descended from Abraham, which probably is even more populous, at least for now, than the family of Israel. Those two families have been, for the most part, bitter rivals. That has certainly affected the history of both of the peoples and will be a major factor in events that take place at the end of the age. As we begin today, I know that much of what we will review is familiar. And I don't mean to either bore you or insult you by being too simplistic. But in order to understand what's ahead, we do need to know and understand what came before. History is not easy to study. In fact, it's something that some people just simply don't enjoy studying. It can be difficult to keep track of all the names and the places and the dates, and it gets kind of confusing. But this is a story that I think you're familiar with. We'll minimize the details as much as we can in order to be sure we understand the series and the sequence of events that take place. We'll be looking into the book of Genesis, but of course you understand that the word Genesis does not appear anywhere in Bible except as the title of this book. Genesis is a Greek word taken from the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. The first word in the book is Bereshith, Bereshith. And that word means in the beginning. So the name of the book is taken from the first word in the book. The English translation of Bereshith is Genesis. The book of Genesis reveals the beginning or the origins of many things that build as we read through the rest of Scripture. First of all, Genesis helps us to see the origin of life, the creation, or maybe better put, the recreation of the earth and the creation of mankind. The book of Genesis shows us the origin of the Sabbath. The Sabbath was part of, or is part of, creation. It's not just a Jewish day, but it was something that was established as a part of creation. The book of Genesis shows us the origin of marriage and family and the structure that marriage and family should have, the integrity of a family. We certainly see in the world today that family is literally under attack. Satan is trying to dismantle and destroy families. God created the family structure and revealed it to us in the book of Genesis. We also see in Genesis the origin of the races. Where do the peoples of the world come from? How do they come to be organized in the nations that we find today? The origin of that goes back to the book of Genesis. And in particular, we see the origin of the nation of Israel. And that nation of Israel, God working with Israel, becomes the focus of the whole rest of the Bible. The origin of it is here in the book of Genesis. Genesis was written by Moses, and apparently he wrote it during the time of Israel's wandering in the wilderness. He also authored the other four books of the Pentateuch, probably as well, most of them during that time, although some, such as some of the details in Deuteronomy, were probably added by Joshua at a later date. Genesis doesn't give us a lot of detail. We find the beginning of certain things, the origin of certain things, which is critical and important to our understanding, but there's not a lot of detail in the book of Genesis, at least initially. The first six chapters of this book cover some 1,656 years in just six short chapters. By the time that sixth chapter is completed, as we read it, mankind had descended into violent chaos to the point that God destroyed everyone on the earth except for Noah, his sons, and their wives. Chapter 7 and 8 tell the story of the flood itself. And chapter 9 in Genesis summarizes events that took place for Noah and his family as they began to establish their life now in a completely new world. So with that brief overview, we've covered over 1,600 years of events. We come to chapter 10 in Genesis, and this is where we'll slow down. Chapter 10 in Genesis is called the Table of Nations. Chapter 10 gives an abbreviated genealogy of the family of Noah and provides a list of his descendants, at least a partial list, as they, again, began to repopulate the earth. So let's turn back to Genesis chapter 10 and get oriented here. Again, this is following the flood, immediately following the flood. This history or this of the genealogy is included. Now, the genealogy, of course, unfolds over several generations, so it's not really in the book at this point chronologically, but it provides as an insert a focus on how the nations of the earth developed after the flood. I want to note in particular, as we start, verse 1 says, "Now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and sons were born to them after the flood." Verse 32 summarizes what we find in this chapter. I'm sorry, before I move on to that point, I want to notice verse 5. So, yeah, this is verse 5. This is the conclusion of the brief comment about the descendants of Japheth. It says in verse 5, "From these, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations." That same comment in general is repeated for each of the three sons. Notice verse 20 at the conclusion of the summary of Ham's family. It says, "These were the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands, and in their nations." And finally, in verse 31, "These were the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands, according to their nations." The descendants of these three sons of Noah were divided by race, in other words, by their descendants, by geography, and by language. God used, in particular, language to separate people to live in groups or to live in areas that would become their nations. God was sorting things out, distributing them as he wanted them to be. Let's consider briefly, verses 2 through 5 list some of the descendants of Japheth. Again, very abbreviated, but some of his descendants. We believe that Japheth was the origin of the Asian people and Native American Indians were descendants of Japheth. But not a lot of detail is given here. In verses 6 through 20, the descendants of Ham are described. We believe that the descendants of Ham are the dark-skinned and black races. But notice a little more detail is given regarding the descendants of Ham. We'll begin in chapter 10, verse 9. Chapter 10, verse 9. Cush, who is Ham's son, begot Nimrod. Nimrod began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Eternal. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Eternal. Nimrod is one of the first notorious men that we find described in the Old Testament. He was the grandson of Ham. The phrase that's used to describe him, saying he was before the Eternal, is better translated in defiance of the Eternal. It doesn't say here what people understood or knew about God following the flood. Certainly Noah, through his and his sons, would have had the stories to tell their families as they grew up and about the God that had rescued them and brought them through the flood. But we don't know what kind of understanding they had, what level of commitment they might have had, or how much he allowed them to fully appreciate him. But we do see here that Nimrod specifically rebelled against God. Verse 11, we see that from that land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh. I skipped verse 10. Verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. And list the other cities, Erech, Akkad, and Calne, all of those cities in the land of Shinar. He was the founder of Babel, And later we see in verse 11, he also founded the city of Nineveh. Two of the cities which really represent rebellion against God himself. Nineveh was at the heart of it. According to the expositor's commentary, his title, Nimrod's title, was Baal, which means the Lord of Babel. And Nimrod appears to be then the origin of pagan gods and pagan religion. Another little detail about the origin of things that we find in the book of Genesis. His cities, we read in verse 10, were in the land of Shinar, which is in the southern area of what became later the nation of Babylon. Also descending from Ham, notice verse 13. Mizraim begot Ludin and several others, and we read at the end of the verse there, it says that from whom came the Philistines. We see here the origin of the Philistine, who were the people who played a very prominent role in causing problems for Israel throughout their history. Descended from Ham. The word Philistines literally means migrants. They were called that because they migrated into Canaan from Egypt. And they settled mostly along the coastline in the Gaza region on the southern coast of Israel. They had five major cities that they built in that area. Notice again then in verse 15, Ham has a son named Canaan. Verse 15, Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and so on. The list of Canaan's sons, and again, Canaan is a grandson of Ham, and then his descendants are listed. And here we find the collection of the Ites, the descendants of Ham through Canaan, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, and so on, those people who were descendant from Ham who became living in the land of Canaan, so they're called the Canaanites. The Canaanites were then the immediate descendants of Ham. And we know that the Canaanites also played a role, along with the Philistines, in being causing much difficulty for the people of Israel. All these Ites were right there in the area called Canaan, which is why it's called that, after the son, the grandson of Ham. I'm sorry, the son of Ham. They had generations in that area to become well established, and they had deep roots in the region. And these were the people that Israel had to displace when they came into the land of Canaan, which God had promised to Abraham's descendants. So we see that from the time Israel entered into Canaan in 1403 BC, there already was strife in the Middle East. Israel had to deal with all the Ites, and they didn't give up their land easily. And in some ways, they really never did give up all of their land. But that comes later in the story. Let's go back then to Genesis 10, and notice verse 21. We find here the list of the descendants of Shem, Noah's son Shem. It says, the father of all the children of Eber. Shem was the father of all the children of Eber. The word Eber, I'm sorry, the word Hebrew is derived from the word Eber. In Genesis 14, verse 13, Abram is referred to as a Hebrew. He was a descendant of Shem, and Shem was the father of all the children of Eber. In other words, the Hebrew peoples were descended from Shem. As history continued, the descendants of Judah in particular became known as Hebrews. But the meaning of the word is not restricted just to Jews. It has to do with the descendants of Eber. A curious statement in verse 25. To Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. No real definitive explanation of that phrase, but it probably refers to the scattering of the people in the division of people into their specific nations, as we saw is mentioned for each of the descendants of those three sons. So we find this brief introduction to the descendants or the races and the division by language and by region of the nations after the flood. Chapter 11, we drop down in chapter 11 to verse 10, we see there's an expansion on the summary of Shem's descendants. They were listed in chapter 10, but there's more to be told about the descendants of Shem than there was to be included for Japheth and Ham. This is because it begins now to lead us to the family of Abraham. Verse 22, we'll just read here, beginning in verse 22, Serug, and we drop down to this list of the children of Shem, or the descendants. Serug lived 30 years and begat Nahor. After he begot Nahor, Serug lived 200 years, had more sons and daughters. Nahor, we'll follow his line. Nahor lived 29 years and begot Terah. And then after he begot Terah, he had more sons and daughters. But now we come to the point. Verse 26. Terah lived 70 years and he begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Terah was the father of Abram. And so when we get to this point, we notice that we're covering vast periods of time in very brief statements. When we get to this point, the pace of the book of Genesis slows down, and there's more detail that is given, because it's going to now provide for us the story of Abraham's life. Abraham is, other than Jesus Christ, the central key figure in all of history. We'll see that God's plan of salvation unfolds and develops around him specifically and his descendants. And the rest of Scripture, from this point forward, is about the history and the future of the physical descendants of Abraham, and ultimately the promise of eternal life for all of mankind. It also came through Abraham. Verse 27. This is the genealogy of Terah. Again, Terah is the father of Abram. Terah begot Abram and Nahor and Haran. Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in his native land in Ur of the Chaldeans. There's no explanation as to what happened to Haran. But after Haran died, we'll drop down to verse 31, Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, Abram's wife, and they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. Again, there's no explanation as to why Terah left Babylon. It was after his son Haran had died, and he had in his mind a move from Babylon, where he was, to move to Canaan. Why he decided to make that move is not explained. but he was on his way. He didn't make it all the way to Canaan. Notice again, we see that Terah took his son, Abram, and they went out from Ur of the Chaldeans. Then verse 31, they came to Haran and dwelt there. They stopped at a place northwest of Canaan, probably would have been in southern Syria or perhaps Lebanon, but they didn't make it into the land of Canaan, even though that's where he had set out to move. And he named the area Hera after his son who had died. So we find Abraham living with his wife, his nephew, and his father in the area of Haran. Obviously, as we see the development of these details of Abram's family, God is working to provide some preparation for the life of Abram and for what he was going to use Abram to do in Abram's life. God was beginning to work out his plan. He was setting things up so that in this area of the world, his plan would begin to develop. This brief introduction we find to the family of Abram leaves us with some questions that we don't know the answers to. Don't usually ask a question unless I can answer it, but there are some questions we could have. Why did Terah decide to move from Ur to Canaan? And although he set out to move to Canaan, he stopped in an area north of that region and lived there instead. Why did he do that? Why did he stop? We don't know how long they lived in Haran before God began to work with Abram and told him to move on to Canaan. But we find the family moving to that region, and the beginning of the story of Abram is here in this aspect of in this part of Scripture. As we continue then into chapter 12. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Now the Eternal had said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I'll curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." God is beginning then to make promises too, and beginning to fulfill the beginnings of his plan, the origin of his plan, through Abram. Abram was living with his family in Haran, and that's an area that later was called Paddan Aram, when God told him to leave his father's house and move into Canaan. Apparently, Terah, who, although he set out for Canaan, wasn't going to get there, he had stopped where he did. And so God told Abram to continue on. According to the chronology that we use at Foundation Institute, this happened in the year 1897 BC. So as God obviously begins here to make promises to and works with Abram, again, some questions come to mind. How did God choose him? How did God choose Abram? He was a descendant of Shem. God obviously saw in him qualities that he was looking for in the person that he needed to fill the role that Abraham did. He would be, as I said, such a central figure in all of God's plan for the completion of it, the patriarch of the nation, and leading to eternal and spiritual promises for all mankind. How did God happen to choose Abram? Notice something else about him, about Abram. Turn back to Joshua chapter 24. Joshua chapter 24. We know that Joshua, the history that's in Joshua, was about the first 5 or so years of Israel coming into the land of Canaan. just pick up a thought here from Joshua chapter 24. Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for the elders of Israel for their heads, their judges, and their offspring, and presented themselves before God. Joshua said to the people, "Thus says the eternal God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods." Abraham came from a pagan family. Abraham, along with his family, served other gods. So we wonder, how was it that God began to work with Abraham? Doesn't tell us the story or the account of how it is that Abraham became to know the true God, the real God. And not only came to know who he was, but came to have such faith in him that he would leave his family and follow the instructions of the God, of Yahweh, of the God that would lead him. How did Abraham come to have this relationship with God? There must have been some kind of a period of time during which God revealed himself to and worked with Abram to convince him and to bring him to the point where he would have that kind of trust to give his life to the God who revealed himself. Anyway, back to Genesis 12. We find here that Abram has now moved into the land of Canaan, and God is beginning to make promises to him about the extent of what his descendants would inherit. And how all of mankind, it says in chapter 12, verse 3, would wind up being blessed through his family. We're going to start skipping ahead through certain portions of it. Go to chapter 13, verse 14. Chapter 13, verse 14. This is after Lot and Abraham had separated. They had so much between them that it was becoming difficult for them to dwell together in the land. And so Abram gave Lot the choice of where he wanted to live. And then they went ahead and separated so that they would not have the conflict between the two parts of the family. Turns out that Lot chose Las Vegas. Lot looked out across the land and he saw the beauty of the land itself and the cities that were in the land, and he was drawn to them. And so he moved his family to Sodom. And already it says in verse 13 that the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Eternal. Don't know if Lot was aware of that already, perhaps even based his decision somewhat on that, or if he just was ignorant of it and stumbled into a really bad scene. But God gave Lot then, through Abram, the opportunity to choose where he would take his family to live. Ultimately, as we go back and review these promises God made to Abram, all of the land was going to be his. Lot's descendants were not going to inherit the land. It would all be Abraham and his family. So in chapter 13, verses 14 through 17, God repeats again the promises that he was making to Abraham and actually even expands a bit upon them, adds even more to the promises he's revealing. The Eternal said to Abram after Lot had separated from him, "Lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, south, north, east, and west. For all the land in which you see, I will give to you and your descendants forever." Lot traipsed off toward the plains of Jordan, to Sodom. But God reassured Abraham that really all this is going to be yours. Just stand here and turn in a circle and look at everything you see. It's all going to belong to your descendants. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth. As if a man could number the dust of the earth, and your descendants could be numbered. Arise, walk in the land in the length and width, for I give it to you. It's an outstanding promise, and certainly one that was very meaningful and encouraging to Abraham, or to Abram at this point. All the land would belong to him and his descendants. Then we have a little adventure here with Lot. We're going to skip over that and move over to chapter 15. Chapter 15, verses 1 through 5, we have another confirmation of the promises. But at this point, it becomes a bit of an issue that Abram doesn't have any children. Chapter 15, verse 1, after these things, the word of the Eternal came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your exceeding great reward." But Abram said to the Eternal, "What will you give me, seeing I go childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus." A servant in his household was, for the moment, his legal heir. And Abram said, "Look, you've given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir." And behold, the word of the Eternal came to him, saying, "This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir." So God repeated to Abram that he would have descendants, and that his descendants then would be able to, would inherit all the land that Abram was dwelling in. Notice that it says, "From your body, you'll have a son." To be fair to Sarah, as the story continues, it doesn't say that his wife would be the mother of the son. It says, "Out of your body shall come this heir," but it doesn't say, technically, doesn't tell us that here that Sarah was to be the mother of the heir. And that led to some complications. Chapter 16, verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "See now, the Eternal has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai, and Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife. And notice the last phrase in this verse. After Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So from the time that God promised Abram an heir and descendants that couldn't be numbered, he still had no children 10 years later. Sarai had the brilliant idea that, well, maybe I can have a son by my handmaid instead of actually being the mother of this heir myself. And years have passed. The promise has not been fulfilled. Verse 4 continues, and it's kind of a natural development. He went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when Sarai saw that Hagar had conceived, her mistress became, I'm sorry, when Hagar saw that she had conceived, then she began to resent Sarai. She felt superior because now she could have bear Abram's child, but Sarai could not. So all kinds of tension develops here within the family as a result of this really kind of a poor decision in human reasoning. As you read on down through verses 6 through 10, we see that the family situation became even more difficult. It became so intense that Hagar fled the household. Verse 6. Verse 5, Sarai says to Abram, "My eyes, my wrong be upon you. I gave you my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes, the eternal judge between you and me. So Abram said to Sarai, indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do to her as you please. And when Sarai dealt harshly with her, she fled from her presence. The situation became so intense that Hagar fled the household. Verse 11. I don't want to get to verse 11 yet. Let's continue in verse 6. So Abram said to Sarai, that she's in your hands, and she fled from the household. Verse 7. Now the angel of the Eternal found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And he said to her, Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? She said, I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarai. She was approached by the angel of the Lord. The angel of the Lord, we know to be actually the Word himself, a manifestation of the Word. It wasn't not just an angel, it was the angel, and it is Jesus Christ as a manifestation of the Word who appeared before her and spoke to her. God could have sent her a message, as we'll see in a few moments, in any way, but he chose to have the Word himself directly deliver the statement to Hagar about what was happening and what was going to happen. That shows the importance of this event. It was especially significant that it was the angel of the Lord who appeared to her and gave her these assurances. Verse 10, then the angel of the Lord said to her, I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so that they shall not be counted for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child, you shall bear a son, you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Eternal has heard your affliction. He will be a wild man, his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he will dwell in the presence of all his brethren. Ishmael is a Hebrew name that means God hears. God heard Hagar and her dilemma, and he rescued her, and he promised that she would bear a son to be named Ishmael, and her son's descendants would be a vast multitude. He said that Ishmael's descendants would dwell with their brethren, but there would be a contentious and belligerent relationship between them. They would not live at peace, but would have a hostile relationship within the family. This describes the first of Abraham's two families. Remember the title, Abraham's Two Families. Ishmael's family is described here, and this is a promise of Abraham's family through Ishmael. The promise of Ishmael's descendants was not a pleasant one. They would live around the edges. They would live near but apart from another branch of the family that would have more wealth. There would be a hostile relationship, and the descendants of Ishmael would fight and scrap to make their way in harsh conditions. Chapter 15, verse 12 in the New International says, Ishmael will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brethren. So notice that it's already starting to get a bit crowded and complicated in this little land of Canaan. Canaanites, the descendants of Ham, are settling into and developing their culture in the land of Canaan. This is the land that God had promised would belong to Abraham's descendants. And now, besides the Canaanites, there's going to be a family issue. Abraham's son Ishmael would live in hostility toward all his brothers. So we see at this early stage, there's already some conflict on the horizon. Chapter 16, verse 1. Chapter 16, verse 1, we read already about Sarai giving Hagar to Abraham to be his wife, and she did bear him the son that we spoke of here. Actually, we were in chapter 16 when we were reading the prophecy about Ishmael. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go backwards. Let's go ahead then in chapter 16 to verse 15. Chapter 16, verse 15. Hagar had become pregnant. She tried to flee from the family because of the intense hostility between her and Sarai. God reassured her that she would have a son and he would become a vast nation, described some of the conditions under which that family would live. In chapter 16, verse 15, Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram named his son Ishmael. Abraham was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. Abraham was 75 years old when he came into Canaan. So now it's 11 years later. Abram is now 86 years old, and his son is born. Chapter 17, verse 1, jumps ahead 13 years. Doesn't tell us anything about the development of Ishmael, about his childhood, about anything about him as a person. We just jump ahead 13 years. We find in chapter 17, verse 1, that Abraham is now 99 years old. And the Eternal appeared to Abram, and again makes promises to Abram about the nation and the descendants that he would be the father of. I am the Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you will multiply exceedingly. Then Abraham fell on his face, and God talked to him, and he said, "As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but now your name shall be called Abraham." Verse 7, "I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you in their generations." Verse 8, "Also I give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." So the promise is repeated and in fact enhanced once again, and Abram's name is changed to Abraham, reflecting that he would be the father of many nations. Each time this promise has been repeated, it's more detailed and is expanded. In verses 15 through 21, now we find the promise to Abraham becoming more specific. Verse 15, "Then God said to Abraham, 'As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name, and I will bless you and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her.'" The promise is made more specifically that Abraham would have descendants who would come through and from his wife, Sarah. And we know that Abraham never doubted God. We know that Abraham never argued with God. Abraham always had faith that God would do what he promised. Turn back to Romans for a moment. Hold your place in Genesis. But turn back to Romans chapter 4. Romans chapter 4, verse 20. This whole section here, beginning back in verse 16, is about the faith that Abraham showed in his relationship with God when God made promises to him. Verse 20, Abraham did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strengthened in faith, giving glory to God, and being fully convinced that what God had promised, he was able to perform. Abraham didn't falter, didn't give up, didn't lose hope in spite of the circumstance. But to go back to Genesis 17 again now, we saw that Abraham's faith was never compromised. Abraham didn't doubt God, but you know, at first, we read here in chapter 17, Abraham kind of reasoned with God a little bit, tried to talk him into something a little different. God said to Abraham, "As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarah, or Sarai, but Sarah." That's verse 15. Verse 17, after the promise has been made to Sarah, Abraham fell on his face and laughed. And he said in his heart, "So shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?" And Abraham said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." Abraham didn't falter and waver in his faith. He didn't doubt God. But it seemed to him possibly a little unnecessary. Why? Should we go through all this? You want us to have a child? Me at 100, my wife at age 90, you want us to have a child? I already have a son. His name is Ishmael. Oh, that Ishmael could be before you, could be that heir. Abraham loved his son. Ishmael at this time is 13 years old. And from the time he was born, Abraham thought he was the promised heir, that God would bring all these promises through. I'm sure that he taught Ishmael what that role would be. Probably taught him as he was growing up that he would be the recipient of all the promises God had given to him. But now God is telling him, no, this son that you love, you've been your son for 13 years, he's not the one. Someone else is going to receive all the blessings and the benefits of being your heir. Abraham had faith. He had faith that God could do what he said he would do, but Abraham also had to have faith that what God was doing was right. He had to be willing, based on his faith, to give up a son that he loved to be replaced by another son. Another side to Abraham's faith. And his first reaction to the promise that we see in Genesis 17 again was, "Oh, that Ishmael might be the one to live before you." But God's answer in verse 19 was, "No, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant." The promise was made in a way that Abraham accepted, but he had to again have faith, not only that being beyond childbearing age, they would have a son, but he had to have faith strong enough to let go of his son. Chapter 21. Verse 5. It says, Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. So he was 99 at the beginning of chapter 17. Now another year has passed. He's 100 years old, and Isaac is born to him. And Sarah said, "God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me." She also said, "Who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? for I have borne a son to him in his old age." God told Abraham that his son's name would be Isaac. The name, or the word Isaac in Hebrew, means laughter, in joy, or amazement. Isaac was an incredible miracle, an amazing gift from God. His name was a testimony to the miracle of his birth. When God blessed her with a son, Sarah got the last laugh. Remember, she kind of laughed when she overheard that she was going to be the mother of Abraham's son. And here she, in a sense, gets the last laugh. People will laugh and, in other words, share the joy and the excitement and the amazing development that I've experienced by becoming the mother of Abraham's son. So at this point, things certainly begin to change for Ishmael. Verse 8. "So the child grew," Isaac grew, "and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned." Typically, at this point, in their culture, in their times, this would be when Isaac was about 3 years of age. About three more years have passed since Isaac had been born. And there's a great feast as he moves on now to the next stage of his young life. "And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, 'Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, Isaac.'" Things already began to change when Isaac was born. In Ishmael's life, he no longer received the special treatment of being the only son and the heir of Abraham. When Isaac was weaned, probably at about the age of three, trouble really came to a head. And Sarah forced Hagar and Ishmael out of the household. In the King James, it said that Ishmael was mocking Isaac. The word translated mocking could be translated playing. Perhaps he was teasing his younger half-brother. Whatever the situation was, it offended Sarah, and she would not allow Ishmael to share the household. She would not allow Ishmael to have any part of the inheritance that would belong only to Isaac. It seems a bit harsh on her part, but certainly it was God's plan that Ishmael would be separated from the family and the two would take very different paths in their life. Verse 17 in chapter 21, God heard the voice of the lad. I'm sorry, this is a little bit further on. Verse 12. "God said to Abraham, 'Do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice, for Isaac, your seed, shall be called the heir.'" So it was God's plan that Ishmael be separated from the family and that Isaac grow up as the only boy in the household and the heir of Abraham. It seems a bit harsh, in a sense, to just throw these two out of the family, but again, it was what God had planned for them. Verse 12. Don't let it be displeasing. We continue into verse 13. "I will make a nation of the son of the bondwoman, because he is your seed." So Abraham rose, verse 14, early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water, put it on her shoulder, and he gave the boy to Hagar and sent her away. Then she departed and wandered into the wilderness of Beersheba. This must have been a very sad day for Abraham. Sending away his firstborn son, now probably about 16 years of age. And we read as we continue into this section that as they wandered into the desert, they nearly died because they were on the journey. They didn't have sufficient food or water, but their lives were spared. And again, God promised to make Ishmael's descendants a great nation. Verse 17, God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said to her, "What ails you?" He says, "Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him in your hand. I will make him a great nation." Hagar, Ishmael, of course, was half Egyptian and half the descendant of Abraham. And so after they had gone off into the wilderness and were separated, it says in verse 20, God was with the lad. He grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife to him from the land of Egypt. So now the paths of Ishmael and Isaac are completely different. Ishmael is out of the family, and he is now going to become part of the Egyptian culture, as his wife presented him an Egyptian wife. We'll conclude today in chapter 24, verse 1. Chapter 24, verse 1. Abraham was old and well advanced in age, and the Eternal had blessed Abraham in all things. So Abraham said to the oldest servant of his home, who ruled over all that he had, "Please put out your hand under my thigh, and I'll have you swear by the Eternal God of heaven and the God of earth that you will not take a wife for my son from any of the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell. But you shall go to my country and to my family and take a wife for my son from Isaac." God's intent was to build a family that was not mixed in with the Canaanites. They were to be separate. Isaac was not to be married to a woman who was not of the family of Abraham. God intended that the promises given to Abraham would be fulfilled by the descendants of Isaac, not a Canaanite or Egyptian descendant. So who would Isaac marry? How would the family dynamics affect the grandchildren and the descendants of Abraham? And what about the continuing influence of the Canaanites in this same region? And what about the family of Ishmael? How will they interact with the family of Isaac? There's much more of the story to be told. And again, as it develops, we see these families, the families of Abraham through Ishmael and through Isaac, developing with implications that reach down through history and into the future. We'll continue with the story of Abraham's families and the origins of the crisis in the Middle East.